You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. It's January 1st, 2026. I'm Sharon Stone. Here at Engage, we have strived to present the important stories and meaningful perspectives in the Central Florida community. We also like to look at the sources of inspiration within our communities. We call these our joy segments. We've put together some of our favorites from the past year. We'll hear about the efforts to preserve the home of civil rights and education pioneer Mary McLeod Bethune, a meetup teaching moms across Orlando how to flip front-side ollies. A Winter Park confectioner shares her story about discovering chocolate for the first time as an adult. And photographer Mei Pang tells the story of John Lennon's 1974 visit to Disney World and how the trip marked the official end of the Beatles. But first, in April, a U.S. district court ruled that the state of Florida was in violation of the Federal Endangered Species Act for its management of wastewater released into the Indian River Lagoon. The environmental advocacy group Bear Warriors argued the discharge killed off seagrass, which led to illness and death among manatees in the region. The suit claimed the state failed to properly regulate the wastewater discharge and contributed to the 358 manatee deaths in Brevard County in 2021. That same month, Engage traveled to SeaWorld Orlando to learn about their manatee rescue program. Manatees face many challenges as the population of Florida continues to swell and coastal communities see increased development. In addition to the dangers pollutants pose to their health, manatees are frequently victims of strikes from boats and are frequently entangled in fishing gear. And when a sick or injured manatee is identified in a Florida waterway, the rescuers from SeaWorld Orlando spring into action. The manatee rescue team has been operating in the shadows of the theme park since 1976. Their commitment is to the safety and preservation of Florida's wild manatee. They are not part of the park's animal presentations. Manatees are rehabilitated with the goal of releasing them back into their natural habitats. Last month, the program recorded its 1,000th rescue, and we stopped by to learn about the team's efforts and maybe meet a few manatees. Kenzie Cudney is a senior zoological specialist on SeaWorld's rescue team. She started with the organization in 2010 and worked her way up to the rescue team 3 years ago. Engaged producer Richard Copeland and I spoke with Cudney as we walked around the manatee rehab facility at SeaWorld Orlando. It consisted of multiple round tanks, about 7 feet tall, dotting a corner behind the park. Each tank had a manatee or three, despite their bulk and power. They glided slowly and serenely across the bottom of the tanks, surfacing every minute or so to draw air through their bovine-like noses. There are currently 37 manatees being cared for at the park. Cudney explains what it takes to feed more than 3 dozen sea cows on a daily basis.
80 to 85 cases of lettuce every single day. Each case is about 25 pounds, about 24 heads of lettuce, mostly romaine. But we do also give them kale, iceberg, and spinach. And we do get some of that. We work with a partnership with Four Roots that is a sustainable local Central Florida farming conglomerate that does kind of help partner with us and provide some of that lettuce for us along with other vendors.
As we walked from tank to tank, I asked Cudney to explain the rescue process. Are they responding to specific calls, trawling the lagoons for injured manatees, or both?
The way that it works is it's all a kind of well put together system through the state of Florida. So usually the Fish and Wildlife Service, along with the national parks and some of the rangers that work at springs around here in Florida that are very well populated with manatees, they have constant volunteers or rangers out there looking for animals. Whether they get a call from a random citizen that a manatee looks beached or injured, if a citizen hits a manatee with its boat and stops and knows it, they might call. Or if the rangers are out looking at animals they see regularly and they see a change or they see something that looks problematic, they're gonna call us as well as keep eyes on that animal. If they make the decision that they wanna do a rescue, they'll call us. Sometimes they say, just send people. Sometimes they say, send people and your boat. Sometimes they say, we already rescued the animal. Can we bring it to SeaWorld for rehab? Because we are the largest rehab center here in the state of Florida. So sometimes we're not on every single rescue, but manatees get delivered here in their ambulances. But either way, if we're called for a rescue, we'll go out, we'll all get on one or two boats. So that means people from other facilities, like Clearwater Marine Aquarium has a rescue team. The Florida Fish and Wildlife has their own rescue team, our team. We might all go out together on a boat, set a net to get that animal that we've been watching that seems critical. We'll use manpower to pull it up onto the boat. and then determine if it does need to be brought back here for rehab. There are some other facilities that do a little bit of rehab, but nobody does the amount that we can do and the amount of critical care animals that we can do. We have the most experience and the best worked vet staff for that. So that can come in at any time of day, any time of night, holidays, weekends, doesn't matter.
What does rehab for a manatee look like?
Lots of different things. If it's something more straightforward, like just being underweight, we'll start out with every animal we get by getting an overall body condition. If they're a little underweight, we'll draw a blood sample and we'll do x-rays to see if there's a reason. Maybe they have an infection that's something inside we can't see. Maybe there's a boat strike that didn't leave a visible exterior injury, but there's internal injuries, broken ribs, collapsed lungs, things like that. Because a boat strike or a blunt force injury doesn't always look as nasty as a scar on the outside. It's usually the internal damage that's an issue. So we'll first get an evaluation. We'll use their blood samples to look for infection or elevated levels of anything that might show a nutrient deficiency or something like that. And then we'll treat them according to plan. At first, they will get tubed any kind of hydration, nutrition, or medicine that the vets determine right off the bat they need. A lot of times with a manatee, we can't make a lettuce sandwich or just hand them a pill. So we are putting a tube into their bellies, either through their nose or their mouth, depending on what's going to be more comfortable for each individual animal. If they're really sick, sometimes their sinuses are really swollen and they can't go through the nose, we'll go through the mouth, which they don't always love, but it is necessary to get them medication or nutrition that they need. Unfortunately, we also do rescue a lot of manatees that are orphaned. Orphan manatees, if they don't have a mom with them and they're not getting milk, won't last more than a few days. So that's a very critical time. If we see an orphan that's with no mom, they'll keep eyes on it for a few hours, a day or two. And if they see no mom or no nursing, we'll bring it in here. And SeaWorld has actually over the years created a formula where we can bottle feed them and get them up to a growing healthy weight. But the state requires they stay here until they're 600 pounds. So a baby orphan manatee might be found at only 30, 40 pounds and might have to be here 2 to 3 years, 4 years until they reach that 600 pound mark. That the state thinks that they're strong and independent enough to then be released. So we have manatees of all different stages and ages going through different types of rehab here in our park.
When we see these manatees on video, you know, we sort of just sort of see these happy little blobs floating around. But I'd imagine spending this much time with them, you find that these manatees have individual personalities.
They do. We'll notice which ones tend to be more social with one another, which ones are maybe less social or more lethargic. We have some that are always constantly swimming, have high energy. They're always bothering the others, or some males that are really into breeding. And then we have others that don't show as much interest in that activity level or that social interaction. So they're a little different. Just like any animal that we work with, some of them are very comfortable with us getting hands on them. If we have to do a procedure, they're pretty calm about it. Others don't like us touching them at all and throw a fit for everything we have to do. That's like any animal or any person, really. I'm not very good at the doctor, so I get it. But we know how to handle that since we do have the most experience. The thing that people maybe don't realize with manatees when they see those cute videos of them swimming out there is if they are uncomfortable or frightened or in a compromised position, meaning sick, separated from their baby, if it's a boy with a really strong mating drive and he's trying to get to females, they can be dangerous. Even if they're not meaning to be aggressive in any way, them trying to get away from a human involves a ton of power and muscle. And there's some manatees that if they don't want to be touched, we can't touch them. It's not safe. They have the power to throw us off and kind of fling their bodies. We call it shrimping, but they'll fling their bodies very forcefully, and a full-grown adult can be thrown from a manatee if that's what they want. So we do everything really carefully. Even though for the most part they are really calm, non-aggressive animals, they still have a lot of muscle and mass behind that.
Just picturing a rodeo rider getting bucked from a manatee.
It's not that different. We wear helmets a lot.
You know, this is sort of transcends just, and I don't mean to be reductive, basic animal rescue. I mean, this is an icon of this region.
This is Florida's bald eagle story, right? So to us, knowing that there's not many places you'll find manatees, they're most populated in Florida. It's not a species of deer or something like that that you'll find in a lot of different places. So when they needed our help, Florida really rallied around it, creating all these boating laws that made a huge difference, protecting waterways, coming up with parks and rangers that patrol and protect our natural springs where we know they gather, and having their numbers bounce back and be more successful is our little bald eagle story. We want to protect these guys, and we know that we've made a difference, so it's very hard for us to think we'll ever let anything bad happen to them again. But that doesn't mean rehab isn't needed. There's always individuals that need our help. But historically, we did make laws and we did take action that has helped their numbers recover from what it was. And if we hadn't done anything, we probably wouldn't be standing here talking about them today.
That was Kenzie Cudney, Senior Zoological Specialist with SeaWorld Orlando's Manatee Rescue Team, speaking with Engage in April of 2025. Back in July, the Mary McLeod Bethune home on the campus of Bethune-Cookman University reopened after an extensive renovation. Today, the home stands as a museum in tribute to the groundbreaking educator. Here's our discussion about the legacy of Mary McLeod Bethune and the role of the home in the BCU community. In 1904, Mary McLeod Bethune created the Daytona Educational and Industrial Training School for Negro Girls. McLeod Bethune put together desks from scrap wood. She raised funds for the school by selling ice cream and sweet potato pies to local laborers. In its first year, the school enrolled 6 students and charged 50 cents for tuition. 2 years later, the school had 250 students. The campus was growing. And in 1913, McLeod Bethune moved into a spacious 2-story arts and crafts home on the school grounds, a house she called home until her death in 1955. The house, which became known as the Mary McLeod Bethune Home, became a nexus of activity with academics, politicians, writers, and artists using the space to share ideas and establish networks across communities. In 1974, the home was designated a United States National Historic Landmark, preserving the legacy of Mary McLeod Bethune and serving as a record of her life and contributions to education and civil rights. Tasha Lucas Yeomans is the dean of the Bethune-Cookman University's Carl S. Swisher Memorial Library. We spoke with her about the reopening of the home.
She called it a retreat. And while it may appear to be a modest home to us, when it was built, it was actually considered a model home. It was built in 1905 by an African-American architect. His name was A.B. Raddick. And not only did he build model homes for the African-American community, but he also built model homes for many white people on the beach side. And so this home was purchased for Dr. Bethune in 1913 by Mr. James Norris Gamble, the chemist who devised Ivory Soap, and by Mr. Thomas White of the White Sewing Machine. And so those two historic figures also make this home significant to the life of Dr. Bethune.
So it's more than a building. Talk about its legacy, both on the Bethune-Cookman University campus and in the larger Daytona Beach community.
Absolutely. It is certainly more than a building. Dr. Bethune, I believe it was in 1953, she declared this home as a foundation. And so it was always her intention at that point forward for people to come into her home to be able to study her life's work and to revisit her legacy, to find out how she lived every day, the people that she interacted with. And so it has been one of the most prominent places to visit on our campus. If you visit the home, we have worked really hard to restore it as it was when she lived there. So you're able to see exactly how it was when she was there. You get to see some of the famous people that she interacted with. So you'll see the Rockefellers, you'll see the Roosevelts, you'll see Madame Pandit, you'll see Langston Hughes, Madam C.J. Walton, anybody that was anybody during that time, you will see pictures of them, photographs of them on her wall. Many of those photographs are autographed directly to her. And so it really kind of gives a greater symbol of who she was connected to and why she was connected to those people and the impact that they had, not just on her life, but also on the local community and Bethune-Cookman.
In touring the home, I know that there's china given to her from John D. Rockefeller on the table. Are there any artifacts in the home that really stand out to you?
As for me, the china. So she has a china gifted to her from the Roosevelts and from the Rockefellers. There's also a very beautiful punch bowl that was gifted to her from the local King family. They owned the local Coca-Cola manufacturer during that time. And so that's one of the special pieces for me. But aside from that, I'll have to go back to that sunroom area. That's where you really get a sense of how wide her reach was in this country and abroad. The sunroom is just filled with pictures. And so you really get an understanding of how she was able to be successful during that time, but also the people that she was connected to. We've worked really hard to make sure that the home, again, is back the way that it was. Most people come in and they think that we have period pieces, right? But they're not. This is her actual furniture. Some of it has been reupholstered. Some of it has been, you know, damaged over the years, but we've restored it. And so just know that when you walk in her home, the things that are prevalent there, the artifacts, the furniture, all of those things are things that she actually owned.
So this has been closed for renovations for, what, 2.5 years? Can you just talk about the upgrades?
When we decided to do this several years ago, I think it was just after the pandemic, the home had started to kind of deteriorate quite a bit, especially the floors. We could see that they were sinking in certain places. And so what we quickly realized is that the pillars underneath the home had really, really started to decay. And we needed to stabilize the home first. And so as you can imagine, a home built in 1905, home that's on a historic registry, that takes some time to do. You have to get a lot of approvals to make sure that it's restored properly. And it also took us some time to find the right architect, engineers, contractors, et cetera, to do this important work. And so that's why it took quite a while. Of course, it's not like a restoration that you would do with your own home. Because of its historic status, we had to make sure that certain things had to be done. And so the first stage of it was selective demolition. And so we were able to take out some of the walls just to kind of see what was going on, where some of the decay was coming from. And then from there, phase two was to stabilize the home. And so I believe it's about 46 pillars that hold the home up had to be rebuilt, and that it was able to stabilize the home. And then phase three was, you know, the replacing the roof, the doors, the windows, and things like that. And so, again, all of those things took a lot of time to make sure that we did it correctly, but we are extremely happy with the results.
Tasha Lucas-Yeomans is the chief librarian and the dean of the Carl S. Swisher Memorial Library at Bethune-Cookman University. Up next in our retrospective of 2025, we'll meet a group of thrashing moms, and a member of the Beatles' inner circle talks about John Lennon's visit to Disney World and the role that trip played in the demise of the group. 2026 is going to be an exciting year in Central Florida. We want to hear from you about the stories you would like to hear in this new year. Is there a member of your community who stands out, or an event that really brings home that neighborhood pride? We'd love to cover it on Engage. You can share it with us by email at engage@cfpublic.org, or you can send us a talkback on the free Central Florida Public Media app. In the menu, select Send Us a Talkback, record your question or feedback, then hit Send. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. Ahead on this program, we continue to take you down the 2025 rabbit hole as we revisit some of our favorite stories from the last year, including a discussion about the role a trip to Orlando played in the breakup of the Beatles.
We were down in Disney World, and two lawyers, John's personal lawyer and one of the lawyers that represented the Beatles, came down to Disney World, all the papers, stacks of them, so that he could sign them there.
Later in the hour, we'll revisit our conversation with photographer and John Lennon confidant, May Pang. But first, few mom meetup groups are dedicated to ollies, kickflips, and rail grinds, but fewer like your mom skates. Back in June, Engage producer Richard Copeland visited the group in Orlando.
It's 6:45 on a Wednesday evening in the Audubon Park School parking lot, and the sun is still fairly high in the sky. On the paved lot, a group of moms are carving turns and working a ramp on skateboards. This is Your Mom Skates, one of the unlikeliest meetup groups you can imagine. They formed last year when a group of moms got tired of watching their kids skateboard and wanted to try it themselves. I grew up in an era when moms instantly equated skateboarding with a trip to the emergency room, and street surfing was tacitly discouraged. I kind of thought that was a universal constant, until I met Christina Brunel.
Last summer, a lot of our kids started skateboarding and started taking lessons. And I personally had just gotten a skateboard because I wanted to learn how to skateboard and didn't have anybody to skate with, didn't know anybody else who skated as far as adults, and kind of like talked some other moms into learning with me, and then found it was kind of hard to like practice and learn with the kids around because, you know, they want your help and assistance. So I was like, why don't we start skating at night? Like, let's do a mom's night. And it kind of just went from there.
What started with four moms who never set foot on a skateboard before last year is now a weekly meetup of 15 women, cheekily called Your Mom Skates. Brunel's husband is a skateboarder, and when her kids took it up, she saw an opportunity to challenge herself.
My husband has skateboarded most of his life. I've always wanted to learn, but was always too scared. And I don't know what happened last year, but I was like, I want to learn. Like, I want to skateboard for my birthday in May. And then just went for it, finally.
The motivation of this group is two-pronged. Most of the moms have kids who are enthusiastic skateboarders and see an opportunity to build on a family activity. But members are finding skateboarding therapeutic, as Your Mom Skates member Laurlee Morrow explains.
I think as you get older, because you're aging and your body's aging, your mind is aging, you're not trying as many, I think in general, and I don't speak for everyone, but at least for myself, you're not trying as many new things as you once were. And I never skated before, but I am athletically inclined. So I love sports and I love games. So this was definitely a challenge for me, especially since I just turned 40 this year. And I was like, I can't break my body doing this, right? So I need to do it the right way. And so that's kind of where our trainer Ashton comes in. So every 2 to 3 weeks, we'll have an actual skate lesson. And they recommend that for anyone starting out, you do the lessons, because the first week, if you're learning how to skate, the first week is really when you have the most accidents, because you don't really know what you're doing, right? And you're probably not doing it safely. And it's given us a lot of confidence. And for me, it's just the consistency of coming out week after week and really building upon those skills. You know, it's like learning any new skill. It just, you're growing, you're learning. It's so good for you. And it's just been really meaningful for all of us, you know, and it's as much social as it is physical.
What are your kids saying about this? What, I mean, when I was 7, my mother was taking disco lessons at the Y. What are your kids?
I would love to meet your mother. I love that. My kids are jealous that I'm here without them tonight. My daughter, June, who's 7, she just wants to do everything all the time. I mean, she wants to learn all the sports, and she's gotten really good at skating, which is really exciting. But I tell them, like, I'm going to this lesson so that I can be better at skating with them so we can skate as a family. And so they get it, but they're very jealous that I'm doing this on my own without them.
The lessons these moms are learning transcend executing tricks. Lauren Eggert found that the strength and courage to skate came from her own son, traits she hopes to impart on him by example.
I actually really try to push Gray to take risks because I feel like it's just going to make him a little bit stronger. When he got into it, all the kids were skating together, and I met Vanessa and her girls. And Gray was like, well, the other moms skate. Why can't you skate? And I was like, oh, no, I'm too old for that. I'm not doing that. And Erica, one of the other sort of founding members, she was like, you know, he can hear you say you can't do hard things. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went and bought a skateboard like the next day.
Luvi Monserretti Corette also came to the group through her kids' interest in skating. She would gather with other moms at the skate parks while their kids were riding when she found motivation from her daughter.
I was like bringing popsicles and like sitting in the heat. And I was like, I want to learn how to do that. And I was like, no way am I going to be able to do that in my head. But I didn't want my daughter to hear me say that out loud. And so then I realized I had to like put my fears aside and learn something new. And then the feeling of community was 100% what kept me coming back every single time, because it wasn't about being cool. It was literally about being with other people that were like rooting you on big time. Every time I would unlock anything, even just an inch of something new, I was getting like cheered for. I'm like in most of the videos dancing for everybody.
And of course, there's the skate gear. Diane Levine's hot pink deck stood out against most of the boards.
I like pink, but I also like dark and scary things. So, I like that combination with the pink and dark and scariness. So, you know, so I want it to be like pink and girly, but also kind of badass. And,
Yeah. Plus, the shape was recommended by Ashton, our instructor. He said you want an old school deck that's stable, that gives you a lot of, you know, comfort as you're riding around in the street. They gave me these big fat wheels so I could roll over acorns and clips and pencils and whatever you see in here. So, yeah, it worked out really perfectly. But I am actually getting ready to level up to a park board, which will be narrower, lighter, harder wheels so I can do tricks.
And as the sun set, I left the group still shredding in the parking lot and showing no signs of slowing down this late in the evening.
That was Engage producer Richard Copeland with the meetup Your Mom Skates. The group meets regularly at Audubon Park in Orlando. We have links to the group on our website, cfpublic.org. When Valentine's Day rolled around last year, our minds went straight to candy. We wanted to meet a local chocolatier to learn about the craft behind handmade cocoa candies. Our search led us to the Maitland Chocolate Factory, where owner and operator Vivian Viteri shared with us both amazing chocolate and an amazing story about how she came to create some of the sweetest confections in the Sunshine State. Upon entering the strip mall store, we were immediately hit with an intense smell of cocoa. Not a cloyingly sweet smell, rather an earthy, nutty kind of tone. The store looked like a mini Wonka factory. Meticulously detailed confections covered every surface of the chocolate shop, owned and operated by Vivian Viteri.
The turtles. Turtles are caramel and pecan inside, and then covered with chocolate. Those are most popular ones in the store. Also, the Oreo cookies, we have them in milk, dark and white. Those are very popular with the kids. And then we have s'mores, and that's graham crackers with marshmallows, dipped in chocolate with some sprinkles on top. And, oh, we also have the sugar-free. Sugar-free is very popular for people, you know, that has diabetes.
Vivian immigrated to the United States from Ecuador as a young woman. She locked down a part-time job at the candy store as a student at UCF. She didn't expect it would turn into a career.
So I started working here as a part-time, and then 20 years ago, and when I was going to school. So when I graduated from UCF, I decided to start my career. And then after the year and a half, when I left the store, the owner called me and he said that he's selling the business. So I decided to buy it.
And therein lies the irony. Vivian never tried chocolate until adulthood. She says it's simply not part of the culinary culture of Ecuador. But once she discovered the cocoa-y concoctions, she was hooked.
The first time I tried, I gained like 30 pounds. Yeah, because I was drinking hot chocolate like 3 cups a day and then trying every truffle that I was making or they were teaching me how to do it. So yeah, definitely. I gained 30 pounds. It's not a joke. It is true.
Obviously, Valentine's Day is a big deal for Vivian. After Christmas, it's the most important day of the year for her business. One of the shop's specialties is their chocolate-covered strawberries. Plump and ripe, the bright crimson fruit are coated in Vivian's dark milk and white chocolates. I asked her how many she expects to move across her counter for Valentine's.
I would say like 5,000 strawberries, something like that. Yeah, because we buy like 20 containers a day. Like each container has like 30 or something like that. Yeah, depends, because sometimes they have bad ones. I always pick the big ones, you know, so the customers get the better quality and the best.
The shelves were stacked with heart-shaped candy boxes of varying sizes and shades of scarlet and pink. Clearly, there's a connection between chocolate and matters of the heart. Vivian shared her take on why chocolate is the go-to gift for all things romantic.
Because it's sweet, and then, you know, then you become, like, more sweeter with your partner. And then also, you know, some people remember memories from when they were a child. Like, I have many customers that they come, and they're like, oh, my mom used to give me these nonpareils and dark chocolate. Or I used to come when I was 10 years old with my parents and always picking up chocolates. And they always give me the stories about, you know, when they were a child. So that's very, very nice.
What Vivian said about chocolate eliciting memories sounded good. Unfortunately, I had some trouble identifying with this. I never ate it as a child.
How does that work?
I was allergic to chocolate.
That's why I love coffee flavored, because my parents gave me something else brown to eat that I wasn't allergic to. So that's why I love coffee flavored things.
I guess my father was a chocolate guy. I grew up in a house with people that ate a lot of chocolate. I remember the big boxes of Nestle Quick powder to make chocolate milk. But I'm also from a part of Pennsylvania that's very close to Hershey. We're near Palmer Chocolates, and those are the people that make all the Easter bunnies and Santa Clauses and things like that. And Wilbur Chocolate near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So I kind of grew up in this weird triangle of chocolate. And I feel like that's sort of informed me more than I realize now that I've spent as much time as I have in here.
Core memory of chocolate?
Core memory of chocolate. Chocolate in the Keystone State.
One of my sisters, actually, when I was growing up, it was an Easter egg basket. She said, hand me one of those chocolate footballs. It's like, do you mean eggs? She said, yes, and that makes entirely much more sense than a football at Easter.
Despite my deeply ingrained dislike of chocolate, how could I not at least try some of Vivian's wares? I felt it was my duty to consume at least one piece of Maitland chocolate, and Vivian offered up a tiny yet decadent dark chocolate truffle.
Not bad, huh?
That's good.
I feel like you've been short chocolate changed your entire life.
You may be onto something.
I think if you like set your metrics at like a Mars bar, mm-hmm. you're not gonna win. If you set your baseline on this, it could only get better.
I think you have unlocked the mystery to why I didn't like chocolate. I just didn't have the right chocolate enter my life yet.
Vivian, look at that. Look what a wonderful job you've done of enlightening Sharon.
I'm amazed to see her face, how she enjoys the chocolate. That's lovely.
You're a miracle worker.
How sweet it is to be loved by you. Feels so fine.
That was Vivian Viteri, owner of Maitland Chocolate Factory, speaking with Engage ahead of Valentine's Day 2025. Coming up, John Lennon visited Orlando in 1974. His trip included a visit to Disney World, where he rode the rides, enjoyed the food, and signed the paperwork dissolving the Beatles. Photographer May Pang shares her story about John Lennon's lost weekend. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Pinball machines used to be a feature of the American landscape, found in every pizza parlor, laundromat, bar, and 7-Eleven across the country. Today, they're more like a piece of American archaeology, a relic to be hunted like treasure by dedicated pinball enthusiasts. Engage producer Richard Copeland found a trove of pinball gold in Oviedo.
It's 7 p.m. on a Tuesday, and it's league night at the Oviedo Bowling Center. The lanes are packed with teams wearing matching bowling shirts, but I'm here for a different league.
Gonna move on yellow belly. Gonna move on Bluebeard.
The bowling center is also home to the Pinball Lounge. Nestled behind the bowling lanes, it's half bar, half arcade, all nostalgia. The lounge has 46 pinball machines lined up in three rows. The sounds from overlapping games creates an electronic din of pinging, banging, and the random exclamations of machines designed to draw players into forfeiting quarters for 2 or 3 minutes of electric gameplay. The machines bear familiar images of pop iconology. Hollywood is well represented. Indiana Jones, Pulp Fiction, and James Bond are all emblazoned in faux Tinseltown incandescence and digitized voice recreations. The rock community is in attendance. Metallica, Rush, and Kiss all grace the back glass of their machines, a tribute to both the gods of metal and the target market of the makers of these games. One of my earliest pinball memories is playing a Kiss machine at Pizza Como in my Pennsylvania hometown in the late 70s.
I was as mesmerized by the band's theatrical makeup and Road Warrior glam costumes, underlit by the 10-watt bulbs illuminating the painted glass, as I was by the actual game. It seems like everybody can recall their first time playing pinball.
Well, the first time I went to the mall without my parents, I went with my friend Adam, and he showed me pinball. We went to the arcade, and he said, hey, you can win a free game when you play pinball. These numbers match at the end, and you get a free game. I said, well, that's cool. And I've always been a frugal person, so learning that you could win free games while playing pinball was great for me. And I'm not very good at video games.
That's Kurt Van Zyl, who co-owns the Pinball Lounge with his buddy Ed Clamp. He's a bowler who was given the opportunity to purchase the Oviedo Bowling Center. The lanes came with a bar, which served more as a storage room than a watering hole. 10 years ago, Van Zyl and Clamp saw opportunity in the unused space.
It'd be a good idea to open up our own pinball place because there was nowhere to play like this in the Orlando area. You'd find one game here, two games there, maybe three games in one place, but to find a collection of machines that, A, work well and are clean and are in quantity was really hard to do.
So starting with 14 machines, they gradually filled up the bar to the pinball-packed lounge that it is today. The next step was bringing in clientele.
Once we opened the pinball lounge, said, well, we need to have a league. We need to have some organized competition every week and get people into this and having a good time and enjoying the fellowship of what we do. You know, you got to have organized play to perpetuate business and have everybody have an extra good time.
I'm one of those Gen Xers whose youth straddled the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I remember when arcades were dominated by pinball machines and skee ball lanes. I also remember when the 80s rolled around, how video games displaced pinball machines, and later, how Nintendo and PlayStation killed the arcades. I asked Van Zyl what drew him to pinball machines in an environment saturated with video gaming options.
It's real, it's right in front of you. You do have control over the machine. You know, if you miss a shot, you're probably not going to get rewarded for missing the shot, but you can sometimes reel those missed shots back and get control again by, you know, strategic nudging and things like that. So, you know, there's nothing programmed to mess you up. There's nothing that's going to make you lose that ball no matter what. You've got control, and that's what I love about pinball and just the feel of it. It's right there. It's right in front of you, you know.
Van Zyl's passion for pinball began where most enthusiasts do, playing as a child. I spoke with players throughout the lounge. I found a similar narrative.
My dad liked to play pinball, so we ended up going as a family to the Altamont Mall every Friday night. We'd have dinner at the food court, and then we would split off. My mom would go shopping, and my dad and I would go play pinball. Sometimes I'd have a friend with me, and we'd go play pinball, too. We'd all go.
Braden Duraza of Mount Dora is just 13, and his introduction to pinball was much like Van Zyl's.
My dad got into it with his friend, and I've loved it ever since. I mean, I always love how I have the best time playing. Everything's different. There's not the exact same game, and I just have a great time every time.
Winter Spring resident Nick Smith was simply looking to meet people when he joined the Pinball League.
Found it on Google Maps, actually. I never really knew much about pinball before coming here, and then just meeting all the people and having the opportunity to play all the games. I like arcade games, and I played video games growing up, and this is kind of it's just more fun arcade, but there's a physical aspect to it and the competitive scorekeeping and the community.
And at its core, this league isn't so much about pinball as it is about community. In an era when gaming typically elicits images of individuals plugged into monitors, remotely interacting with others, if at all, the Pinball Lounge and League offers an opportunity to hoist a beer and pump some quarters with friends and family, old and new.
You need to have that interaction that's in person. You need to be able to spend time with people. You need to have a little bit of friendly competition. You need to break bread. You know, and it becomes way more than people playing pinball against each other here. You know, people become friends. They help each other move. They go to each other's weddings. They go to each other's funerals. It's become a community.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him in any amusement hall. That black death on the black kid. Sure plays a mean pinball.
That was Engaged producer Richard Copeland at the Pinball Lounge in the Oviedo Bowling Center.
He's a pinball wizard.
In 1974, John Lennon found himself somewhat adrift. The Beatles had been disbanded for nearly 4 years, and while Paul, George, and Ringo were successfully pursuing solo careers, John had found his creative juices drying up. His relationship with wife Yoko Ono had become strained, so they agreed to take a breather. Lennon spent time traveling and decompressing with his assistant, photographer May Pang, with whom he had developed a relationship. Their time together led to John Lennon's legendary Lost Weekend, which was really 18 months spent writing music and partying hard. It was during this time that Lennon and Pang visited Orlando, along with Lennon's oldest son, Julian. And it was during that trip that the final nail was driven into the Beatles' coffin. May Pang was in Ormond Beach last January to present an exhibit of photographs she took during Lennon's Lost Weekend. She took some time to talk with us about their time in Central Florida, beginning with why she feels calling it a lost weekend was a misnomer.
First off, everybody thought that my time with John was just a weekend. But what it was that John got tired. And when he was interviewed at one point, you know, he happened to mention, oh, it was a lost weekend. And he used to use metaphors from the movies and everything back then. And of course, there was a movie about a guy who was drunk and woke up and, you know, was constantly drunk and didn't know what was happening. And so he used that because the couple of times that he made the press, which is always the big thing, was he was with Harry Nilsson. And the press happens to keep referring to those times. And it's, you know, we're talking a couple of times. And people kept saying, oh, he was just drunk the whole time. No, he wasn't. But you know what? That's the way the press ran at the time. And I would say to people, I said he would go out with the boys. And they'd go out and have a good time. But if you're going to say, who's going to make a better copy? You know, Harry was the biggest instigator. And I laugh, and I loved him dearly. But he was the biggest instigator. And I would say to him, you know, to everyone, I say, who's going to make a better copy for your newspaper or your magazine? Harry Nilsson, who's caused trouble? Or the guy that he's hanging with, John Lennon? So that's how it started.
During this time, you were instrumental in encouraging John to patch up his relationship with the other Beatles and also his son, Julian.
Yes. And, you know, I know what it's like to not have both parents be in your corner. And he hadn't seen his father in 3 years, at least three and a half, actually. And he was an 11-year-old kid who needed his father. And it was important. And I saw the opportunity to hook them together and also for him to have closure with his ex-wife, Cynthia Lennon. And it worked because whenever he would call prior to this, it was, oh, I don't like speaking. I don't want to speak to Cynthia. I don't want to speak to anyone. And now it was easier. All of a sudden it was like, oh, hi, Sin, how are you? Oh, who are you seeing? Oh, tell him I said hello. You know, it was easier and it was better for Julian. And I thought that it was good because then it made way for everyone around us, you know, I mean, and all his friends from back then. And for all the things that I had done and help him pave that way, you know, it also made for all the good stuff that went on with him making good music, which was a lot. He did more music in the time we were together than any other time during his solo career.
Why did you encourage him to fix relationships with the other Beatles as well?
They're your bandmates. They're your friends. To fix your relationship with people that you're still involved with business-wise, it's not a good thing to leave it at a bad place. And besides, he was still talking to them. And what better way is to smooth everything out and see everybody face to face? So we got the chance to see everyone and everybody had a good time. It was like the old days. There was no animosity when we walked in the room. Whatever it was, it got fixed and they moved on.
I have to ask you about accompanying John Lennon to Disney World in 1974. Before we get to the significance of what happened there, can you just
give me a sense of what was his impression of the area then?
Well, you know what? It was 1974 was our Christmas holiday with Julian. And he had arrived over and we said, oh, we're taking you to Disney World. We had already been to Disneyland, so now we're at Disney World. And, you know, 11-year-old kid who didn't want to go to Disney World, you know, or any of those places and get on those rides. And it was fun. It was going to be new. We hadn't seen Julian since the summer. So this was our time with him. We also went to Palm Beach as well.
You were with him as he signed the paperwork officially dissolving the Beatles, December 1974, at Disney World, of all places. Can you talk about that moment?
John was supposed to sign the agreements and for the dissolution of the Beatles and everything a couple of weeks earlier. And this has been years in the making with all the lawyers and everything. He finally was about to sign and he was going over everything. And there was one thing that bothered him. And there was one issue in there. And it was about the taxes that would be left on the table. I guess, you know, he would be the responsible one because he was the only one living in America. Because there were like 35 to 40 people in a room negotiating at all times. You know, you have the Beatles as the entity besides individuals, but the Beatles, both America and the UK. So it was always a complicated situation. But closing this, whatever taxes came would be on John's shoulder because he was the one living in America. And he started to not like that bit. And he wanted some help. And so at the 11th hour, almost the time when everybody was supposed to sign, he backed out in signing and said, I want this fixed. And they did. And by the paperwork needed to be signed before the year ended. Everybody else had signed it except for John. And so when it was all fixed and the lawyer gave him the go ahead that it was fine, we were down in Disney World and two lawyers, John's personal lawyer and one of the lawyers that represented the Beatles, came down to Disney World with all the papers, stacks of them, so that he could sign them there.
So after the issues, that the practical stuff gets worked out, take me to the moment. What was the demeanor? Is this a moment that's nostalgic? Is it bittersweet? Or was it just a relief?
I think for John at the time when he was signing, it was a relief. Besides, remember, all four guys, I mean, they had to pay thousands of dollars for all these lawyers for the last couple of years to be at these meetings. And, you know, it was money going out the door. But it was finally over. It didn't stop them. What people don't understand, it pulled them apart from being Beatles. But they were still friends. They could still do things together and still get the credit. For instance, I laugh, I have this certificate on my wall. It said yesterday, written, you know, by from BMI saying, given to John Lennon for one of the most requested played song of that year. We all know that John had nothing to do with it, and it was really Paul. So this type of thing, and it was always back then under the old contract, everything, whoever wrote it had to be Lennon McCartney, whether one or the other wrote it or not. So in this instance, as they're breaking down all the publishing, all the stuff, they get a chance to now be themselves and they can still hang out with each other, still write with each other, still play and perform as individuals without the headache.
How did this, well, not weekend, but how did this lost weekend, so to call it, come to an end? And what's your relationship with John and Yoko after?
Let's put it this way. My relationship with John never really ended. And we stayed in touch until he was no longer here. We talked, we seen each other privately. And my relationship with John was just that, it was with John, not Yoko. I had no relationship with Yoko.
Who's the John Lennon that you saw? Without the cameras, without the fans, the bands, you know, was he silly? Was he serious?
He was only serious about his work. You know, I know it's hard to believe, but there was a part of him that was naive at times. He didn't experience, you know, he was ushered from a very young age, if you think about it, from one thing to another. You know, one day he said to me, what should we do today? And this is when we were in New York City. And I said, I'm going to take you on a bus ride. And he just gave me this look. And he said, a bus ride? And I said, yes. You always wanted to know what New York City was about. And I said, let me show you New York City the way I saw it. So I took him on a bus. And he was fascinated. Of course, it was empty when we started. By the time we reached a certain street, it was like it was packed. People started to notice him sitting there. And they went, oh, my God. And somebody yelled out, hey, John, how are you? And John turned around and he said, I'm fine. And then the guy yelled out, I told you it was him. And John looked at me and says, time to leave. And we got off the bus.
That was photographer and John Lennon confidant May Pang speaking with Engage in January of last year. That's all for today's edition of Engage. Join us next Thursday as we discuss the impacts the ACA tax subsidy sunset are having on healthcare access across Central Florida. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for joining us. All Things Considered is coming up following NPR News.